Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. Several large and small fires are burning across the state of California. A cluster of fires that began on Friday have forced evacuations in the rural areas of Trinity and Humboldt counties. Firefighters are still fighting the deadly McKinney Fire in Klamath National Forest near the Oregon border. As of yesterday, the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection reported that the blaze has burned more than 60,000 acres and was 40% contained. 87 homes and 47 structures have been destroyed. More than 3,500 fire personnel are involved in battling that fire, according to CNN. Last month's Oak Fire near the community of Mid Pines between Mariposa and Yosemite National Park scorched over 19,000 acres. 127 houses were destroyed, along with 66 outbuildings. Last year, more than 2.5 million acres burned in California, including the 960,000-acre Dixie Fire, the state's second largest blaze on record. We have done so many shows about how the climate crisis is increasing the frequency and the severity of wildfires and ravaging our landscapes. So what is being done to reduce forest fires in California? What is most effective? In his recent San Francisco Chronicle article, environment reporter Curtis Alexander reports on why the state is not staffing an adequate number of firefighters to combat California's fires. The lack of staffing means less capacity to put out fires and protect people and property. Curtis Alexander is an enterprise reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle with a focus on natural resources and the environment. He writes about water, wildfire, climate, and the American West. Hi, Curtis. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And in a recent New York Times op-ed, Dr. Chad Hansen wrote about the impact of logging on forest fires and how federal land agencies like the U.S. Forest Service and the National Park Service are under significant political pressure to conduct commercial logging operations that benefit timber companies but tend to exacerbate overall fire severity. Dr. Chad Hansen co-founded the John Muir Project in 1996, an organization dedicated to the ecological management of federal public forest lands. He first became involved in national forest protection after hiking the 2,700-mile length of the Pacific Crest Trail from Mexico to Canada in 1989. And during this hike, he witnessed firsthand the devastation caused by rampant commercial logging on national forests in California, Oregon, and Washington. Dr. Chad Hansen is co-editor of the book, The Ecological Importance of Mixed Severity Fires, Nature's Phoenix, and author of Smokescreen, Debunking Wildfire Myths to Save Our Forests and Our Climate. Hi, Dr. Hansen. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Great to have you. Well, Curtis, I want to start with you because you have to leave us in about 10 minutes. Last year, we saw mega fires destroying hundreds of millions of acres in California, just again, devastating entire communities. And it's just so devastating. This year, we've got the McKinney Fire. It's been the largest. The fire season is by no means behind us. Can you just give us an update on the McKinney Fire? It looks like the latest numbers now, tragically, 5 people have lost their lives.
Yeah, I heard some talk in the newsroom this morning that a 5th person has died in that fire. They just weren't able to get out, unfortunately, and burned. What I'm hearing about that 5th person too is they were a volunteer that worked at a fire lookout station. So really sad. But that fire, as you mentioned, is the biggest we've seen so far this year, and it is really a beast. It started. A lot of firefighters thought they'd be able to jump on it pretty quickly because even though we've had some big fires this year, they've been sort of, they haven't been at the same time. So Cal Fire and the Forest Service have been able to pounce on these things and get control of most of the fires so far. With this one, the winds really picked it up. And in a matter of 48 hours, the fire had already burned 50,000 acres, which is huge acceleration. Fortunately, over the past week, especially midweek last week, it cooled down a bit. There was some rain, so firefighters have been able to get in there with bulldozer and put a containment line around this. And as you said in the intro, it's about 40% contained.
And what's so devastating is CNN reports that Valerie Linfoot and her husband, both retired forest fires, lost their home of more than three decades. Valerie Linfoot said, "This is a small community. This is absolutely devastating to Klamath River. I don't know how they're going to recover. None of us are rich people. We are all hardworking and resilient people. But most people that were down there are middle class, regular working folks or retirees."
Unfortunately, we're seeing more and more of this across California. The wildfire crisis is really something that rural areas have to deal with, and often it's very poor rural areas. So when it comes to finding new housing, obviously that's a problem in California. It's a particular problem when you don't have a lot of money.
Oh, so just so devastating. Getting into the piece that you just wrote, which is so important, it's about the shortage of firefighters in California, which is crucial for very obvious reasons. You report that as California's wildfire season ramps up, the number of federal firefighters in the state is down, way down, plummeting to its lowest level in years, despite pledges by fire officials to have boosted the ranks before a potentially busy summer. So why is this happening?
Well, the problem is really with the Forest Service. The Forest Service kind of works with CAL FIRE, which is the state firefighting agency. They put out the bulk of fires during fire season in the state. And firefighting to begin with is a hard job. So it has always been somewhat of a problem to hire firefighters. It's hard work. The hours are long. You're away from home for sometimes weeks at a time. And it doesn't pay very well. And I think with the coronavirus pandemic, a lot of firefighters decided to sit out either because they were sick or they had family members who were sick or they didn't want to get sick. And I think during the coronavirus pandemic, a lot of people sort of rethought what they were doing in their work. So about 3 years ago with the pandemic, the Forest Service saw a serious decline in its staffing. And that decline has only continued. I spoke with the Forest Service this winter to see if they were doing more hiring because we've had two big fire seasons. And obviously the last thing you want after two big fire seasons is to lose more firefighters. And they said that they were doing hiring campaigns, doing job fairs, doing online things, but they just weren't able to hire staff on. And in fact, over the past year, the number has fallen even more. The Forest Service is short almost 1,300 firefighters in California.
I think a lot of people would be shocked to learn that entry-level pay for Forest Service firefighters was $13.45 an hour. So if we just sit with that for a minute, we're talking about a very expensive state, no matter where you live. And then, as you said, this job is so incredibly difficult, emotionally taxing, physically taxing. And then Senators Feinstein and Padilla, they urged Biden to boost entry-level pay for these firefighters. So it went from $13.45 to just $15 last year. I mean, you can't live on that in this state.
Yeah, it's really tough. And they are working to try to increase the compensation. Last year, as you said, Biden issued an executive order, which at least raised the pay for entry-level firefighters to $15 an hour, which I think is about comparable with the state's minimum wage. I mean, before that, as you mentioned, you can make more money working at a fast food chain or at a retailer of some sort. The Infrastructure Act, which was passed by Congress last year, included money for raises, and those are currently going out, which is a good thing in terms of attracting and retaining firefighters. And under that plan, firefighters will get a boost of 50% in their wages or up to $20,000. The only problem is that the money for this is temporary. It will be gone in less than 2 years. So a long-term fix when it comes to the wages of firefighters is still needed. Most firefighters tell me, and the Forest Service certainly says, if they have higher wages, they'll have a much easier time doing the hiring that they need to do.
You know, I think this is something that so many people just take for granted, that someone is going to show up to fight these fires. I mean, in the case of the McKinney fire, you've got 3,500 people involved in battling that fire. I mean, that's a lot of people, trying to take out that fire. Can you just give us a sense, when you talk to these firefighters, what do they tell you about what this job is like?
Well, most of them that I talk to take a lot of pride in their job, and they love going out there, and they see themselves as public servants, which they certainly are. And we have countless times where firefighters have saved whole communities. And so I think a lot of them who are leaving the field are doing so reluctantly. They really like what they're doing, but often they're starting families or they want to have some more consistency in their lives. They don't want to be bouncing around between states putting out fires, especially when they're making so little pay. So a lot of them are leaving, but they don't want to leave. The other thing I should add is that city fire departments and a CAL FIRE pay a lot more money than the Forest Service. So you are seeing a lot of people move from the federal agency to state and local agencies. And, you know, the missions are a little bit different. So it's not like it's okay if they move from the federal lands to state and local lands, because they really are doing different things.
You mentioned in your piece that a sweeping package of drought and wildfire bills approved recently by the House passed, but it's less certain to be acted on by the Senate. This would at least make a portion of these pay increases permanent. It also includes first ever mental health leave for federal firefighters, expanded eligibility for hazard pay, and the elimination of overtime pay caps. Can you just tell us more about this? And then, I mean, what would it take for this to be? It seems like such a no-brainer. But then again, I mean, not one Republican voted for the Democrats' climate and health bill, which was just drastically scaled down.
Yeah, and this package of drought and wildfire bills that you mentioned is also sort of a partisan effort. It is supported by Democrats. There are some Republicans who do support some of the bills in the package. I think it's a package of about 49 bills. And it did get through the House last week, as you mentioned. But I don't think it stands too much of a chance in the Senate, because the Democrats have they don't have the votes to get it through, or barely the votes to get it through, and won't have the support. But I think there still is I think there are people on both sides of the aisle who are interested in seeing firefighters make more money, get more compensation. As you said, it's not just the money. It's about mental health. It's about having more time off. It's about retirement. It's about, you know, better benefits, having a more stable life, people wanting to get into this field rather than having to try to get out of it. So, you know, if it doesn't pass in this next package of bills, hopefully Congress will find a way to increase the pay.
Curtis Alexander is an enterprise reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle, and you can find his piece, "It Scares the Heck Out of Me, California's Federal Firefighter Shortage Has Gotten Dramatically Worse." Let's bring Dr. Chad Hansen into this conversation. Dr. Hansen, you just have to shake your head. I mean, $15 for these firefighters who are putting their lives on the line to save homes and communities, $15 an hour. I mean, what are your thoughts on this?
It's completely unacceptable. It's been unacceptable for a very, very long time. We need to raise the pay for wildland firefighters, and we need to raise a number of benefits because it is extremely difficult and hazardous work, and is extremely important for communities. And I stress that because there's one thing that's been happening recently that it's a positive shift, is that more and more of the focus of wildland firefighters has been on what we call structure defense. Basically, in advance of the flames, doing that kind of defensible space pruning within 100 or 200 feet of the homes, helping people and their animals evacuate from communities when the fire is approaching. Evacuation assistance and structure defense saves homes and it saves lives. And also, we're seeing a trend towards, you know, laying down lines of water drops at the edge of a community, which can make a big difference if it's repeated. That really makes a huge difference. And again, it's a profound public service, and we need to reward wildland firefighters accordingly. The thing that's not effective is trying to stop fires in the wildlands from spreading. Once they're going, once they're beyond, you know, a small fraction of an acre or a few dozen acres, that's when mostly they're put out. But once they get bigger than that and they start moving, even if they're slow moving, they really can't be put out because they're driven by wind and climate and hot, dry, wet, you know, windy conditions. And asking firefighters to try to put those out is really just putting them at risk unnecessarily. And that's a dangerous thing.
Curtis, before we let you go, to Dr. Hansen's point, what are you hearing from California officials and people on the front lines of these fires about what is most effective? How have they changed their fire management policy and practices over the years?
Well, one thing that I will add is that the same fire force, the wildland firefighters that are trying to save the communities from these large fires are the people who do a lot of the prevention work, the upfront work, the prescribed burning, the structure safety, the home hardening, the creation of defensible space between communities and forests. So when you're losing firefighters who are trying to put out the fires, you're also losing the workforce that is doing a lot of the prevention work up front. I think to your question about what is most effective, there is some debate about what's effective right now, and a lot of people are trying a lot of different strategies to make the forests more fireproof. I think people will agree, because of the history of fire suppression in this state, that there is a lot of overgrowth, a lot of vegetation that hasn't burned, a lot of understory in the forests that have made these fires burn really, really hot and very fiercely, especially in a warmer, drier climate. So I think putting some of the fire back on the ground, doing prescribed burning, that the intentional lighting of fires can really help sort of, you know, restore some of the natural conditions on the ground and make the forests a little bit safer so that when fires do start, they don't burn as badly, as well as hardening communities and creating more space around communities so that fires aren't going to overtake structures and burn homes and, you know, prevent the loss of life.
Right. And then, of course, there's always that debate. And I just wonder what your thoughts are on this, where that debate is about expanding housing in the wildland urban interface, because since 2017, California has experienced 8 of its 10 biggest blazes, and more than 10 million acres and thousands of homes have burned in these areas.
Yeah, there's no doubt that when you're moving out to the wildlands, the forests, where it can be very, very beautiful and very peaceful, you are taking on the risk of having your home burned in a fire. The problem is, in a lot of the urban areas where there isn't a risk of fire, you have home values just shooting up. So a lot of people who are moving to be smaller communities aren't doing so necessarily because they want to, but they have to. They're being forced there by the higher home prices. So, I think as long as California has a housing crisis, you're going to have people living in these areas, whether it's a smart thing to do or not.
Right. Well, Curtis, thank you so much for your important reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Curtis Alexander is an enterprise reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle, and you can find his latest piece, It Scares the Heck Out of Me, California's Federal Firefighter Shortage Has Gotten Dramatically Worse. Staying with us for the rest of the hour is Dr. Chad Hansen, who co-founded the John Muir Project in 1996, an organization dedicated to the ecological management of federal public forest lands. Dr. Hansen wrote an op-ed with Michael Dorsey, who's director and chair of the Rob and Melani Walton Sustainability Solutions Service at Arizona State, for the New York Times, called The Case Against Commercial Logging in Wildfire-Prone Forests. And if you have any questions or comments about the state of fires in California, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Chad, since we were just talking about where people are living now and this debate about living in these wildland urban areas, I just wonder what your thoughts are on this.
Well, yeah, I mean, Curtis makes a really good point about the expense in urban areas, and it's driving some people out into more rural areas. I mean, I feel like the solution is really twofold there. Number one, I think we need to focus new developments in the cities, you know, urban infill, and in places that are not out in the wildlands. And we need to build up in the urban centers, and make it more affordable and create more housing in those urban centers, so people don't feel compelled to move out to more rural fire-prone areas just for financial reasons. And I think the other part of it, and this is key, and then Curtis mentioned this too, I think correctly, which is we have to focus our attention and our resources on saving homes and lives in the communities. We have to give support to these towns that are vulnerable, that are suffering, that are being impacted, where homes are being lost, where lives are being lost. That has to be the focus. And the good news is we know how to do that properly. And not just, you know, during fire season when the fires are occurring, but also before fire season starts with defensible space pruning, 100 feet around homes, home hardening assistance, basic things that help keep, you know, people safe and help homes from burning. The problem is that's not where most of the money's going right now. Most of it's going into backcountry logging under deceptive euphemisms like thinning and fuel reduction.
Okay, so we're going to talk about that in a minute, but I also just wanted to ask you, what are your thoughts about what is happening at the state level and then at the federal level? We're going to have an in-depth conversation tomorrow about what is in the Democrat scaled-down climate, health, and tax bill. For the purposes of today's show, of course, the climate portion of the bill contains $370 billion in renewable energy tax credits over 10 years, but it also includes unprecedented support for new drilling, which is why frontline communities oppose it. And Chad, when you look at a study that just came out of the UN, it projects that the risk of extreme wildfires, even with deep cuts to greenhouse gas emissions, would rise 14% by 2030, 30% by 2050, and by the end of the century, 50%. I mean, you can't even wrap your head around an increase of 50% given what we deal with today in the state of California and also in other Western states.
Yeah, I mean, this is a key point. And this, you know, if there's one point that I really want to get across to folks, you know, as a scientist, as a researcher in this field, it's that fires are primarily, overwhelmingly driven by weather and climate, and therefore also climate change. These are climate-driven events. They always have been, even, you know, for tens of millions of years before humans ever walked the planet. These are climate-driven events. And you're not going to solve them with bulldozers and chainsaws, and you're going to have to get a handle on climate change. And so, you know, I really want to stress that, because anything that we're doing in terms of federal or state policy that doesn't recognize that is going to put people at greater risk.
So what are your thoughts on this bill that took, you know, months and months to hammer out and to get Senator Manchin to agree to, which includes support for unprecedented drilling?
I think the bill is a terrible bill, and it's one of the most widely misreported pieces of legislation that I've ever seen in the past, you know, 30 years. The narrative is that the Manchin bill would reduce carbon emissions in this country by 40% by 2030. Literally none of the reports that have come out about the bill from different modeling firms, literally none of them actually say that. What they say is that existing policies they're projecting will reduce carbon emissions by 26 to 30% by 2030, depending upon the report and the group of people doing the modeling. They claim that the Manchin bill will contribute an additional 8 to 12% or so emissions reduction of carbon by 2030. The problem is that they have all kinds of industry assumptions built into that model, such as the assumption that we'll just capture the carbon and store it underground and it won't be a problem. And so therefore doubling down on fossil fuels, on coal, on oil and gas drilling and pipelines, on destructive things like cutting down our forests and burning the trees for energy, what we call biomass logging, it doubles down on that. These things all contribute to climate change in a massive way. But the assumption behind the Manchin bill and the modeling that's been gone on into it is that we'll just capture the carbon and stick it underground, and so we don't have to worry about it. And so to me, it's a very, very dangerous myth, because that's been discredited by climate scientists for decades. We know it's not true. And, that's just one problem in terms of the modeling, but it's just an example.
You know, Dr. Hansen, before we go to break, I want to ask you one more question about this, because it's so incredibly important. A lot of the scientists and environmental advocates we have had on the show who are doing really good work are praising this bill, saying, we worked so hard to get this. This is progress, but the fight continues. And this is the message that we are reading. So what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I understand. I think, you know, on a purely human level, people are just desperate for a win. They want to see progress. They want to believe that this, that you know, Senator Manchin, you know, actually woke up one morning and decided, hey, listen, I'm actually going to do the right thing here. I get that. I understand and respect that kind of optimism. I'm fundamentally an optimist myself. I do believe we will get a handle on the climate crisis over the course of the next 10 and 20 years. But this bill is not that vehicle, unfortunately. And the problem is if we're not honest about what this bill really is, which is a massive expansion of fossil fuel extraction and infrastructure, subsidies for the fossil fuel industry, drilling on tens of millions of acres. If we're not honest about that, we're going to make things worse. I believe that if you actually do an honest accounting, carbon accounting of this bill, the net effect is an increase in carbon emissions, not a decrease. And we just can't afford that right now. We can't afford to get it wrong. So I understand the optimism and the desire to see a win, but this is not a win.
Well, we are going to talk more in depth about the climate portion of the bill tomorrow, and we will definitely bring your perspectives to the show because it's so important. Dr. Chad Hansen co-founded the John Muir Project in 1996, an organization dedicated to the ecological management of federal public forest lands. Today, we are talking about forest fires in California, what is being done to restore California's forests and reduce wildfire risks, what is most effective. This is Your Calls One Planet series. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will begin a three-day series on the Democrat scaled-down climate health and tax bill. It passed the Senate over the weekend without one Republican vote. We are going to begin by discussing the climate portion of the bill. You just heard today's guest, Dr. Chad Hansen, analyze that portion of the bill, and we will continue the conversation tomorrow. We're speaking with Dr. Chad Hansen about wildfires in California. He co-founded the John Muir Project in 1996. He first became involved in national forest protection after hiking the 2,700-mile length of the Pacific Crest Trail from Mexico to Canada in 1989, and during the hike, he witnessed firsthand the devastation caused by rampant commercial logging on national forests in California, Oregon, and Washington. If you have any questions for Dr. Hansen, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. So, Dr. Hansen, what an amazing experience to hike the 2,700-mile length of the Pacific Crest Trail. Tell us how you were affected by seeing logging, and what did you see exactly in California, Oregon, and Washington?
Yeah, I took a year off college to do this. I was 22 years old at the time. My older brother agreed to go with me, and I was not politically active at the time. I was not involved in any way. I was a student, but I wasn't contributing to society in any meaningful way other than that. And I really didn't understand at that time the distinction between national parks and national forests. The national parks are landscape that's supposed to be protected from things like logging, and national forests have a logging program under very, very old federal laws that basically allow U.S. Forest Service to sell public trees to private logging companies and keep the revenue. And that system is wreaked havoc on our forests for many decades. And we began seeing that once we reached the northern Sierra Nevada. We began seeing these vast areas that had been logged and clear-cut, and the devastation and the loss and degradation of forest ecosystems off and on all the way up through Northern California and Oregon and Washington. And it really affected me. I decided at one point in a huge clear-cut in Oregon, sitting on a six-foot diameter old-growth stump, that this is what I was going to do with my life. I was going to be involved in forest conservation, and ultimately that led me to research as an ecologist.
So let's talk about what you have learned as a scientist about logging. In your New York Times op-ed, you write, "The truth is that logging activities tend to increase, not decrease, extreme fires by reducing the windbreak effect that denser forests have, for example, and by bringing in highly combustible invasive grasses that are spread by logging machinery." So tell us more about what you have learned.
Yeah, there's a growing consensus in the scientific community about two key things. You know, number one, wildfires are driven mostly by weather and climate, as I mentioned earlier. And number two, that when you change the microclimate of a forest, you can make it more vulnerable to the extreme weather events that we're seeing more frequently with climate change. And I'll explain what I mean by that. In a dense, mature forest, you have, on one hand, more biomass, more carbon. And a lot of people assume on the superficial level that, well, that means there's more to burn. And it must be more prone to burning and maybe more intense fires simply because there's more biomass. It's much more complicated than that. In forest ecosystems, a denser, more mature forest actually has higher canopy cover. And higher canopy cover means there's more cooling shade of that canopy cover, more cooling shade that keeps the forest floor more moist during fire season and more shaded. And in fact, a denser stand of trees acts as a windbreak against the winds that drive the flames. But when logging occurs, including what's kind of euphemistically called thinning, what we call commercial thinning, which simply means removing a whole bunch of mature and even old growth trees in addition to some small trees, when that happens, much of the forest canopy cover is degraded and more sunlight is reaching the forest floor. You have hotter, drier, windier conditions, and the winds can sweep the flames through the forest more rapidly.
So talk about how these decisions are made and what kind of political pressure are you talking about? Because in your piece, you write, federal land agencies like the U.S. Forest Service and National Park Service are under significant political pressure to conduct commercial logging operations that benefit timber companies, but tend to exacerbate overall fire severity. So tell us more about that.
Yeah, it's a great question. There's a conversation in the public dialogue about how, you know, previous fire, whether it's a previous wildfire or prescribed, you know, burning, can reduce the sort of pine needles and dry leaves and seedlings and saplings on the forest floor, and it can modify the behavior of the next fire. And that's absolutely true. The problem is that's not what's happening out there under the guise of things like thinning and fuel reduction. And so the public is being misled. What's really happening the great majority of the time is these are industrial logging operations that are removing mature trees, old growth trees, big fire-resistant trees that comprise the forest canopy and that actually make the forest more shielded from extreme weather. And what's happening is that because of these old laws that the U.S. Forest Service is governed under, that allow and encourage the Forest Service to sell public trees to private logging companies, the Forest Service is under pressure in two key ways. Number one, Congress doesn't appropriate enough money to the Forest Service to do certain things. And so the Forest Service tries to make up for that shortfall by selling large swaths of trees on public lands to logging companies. And scientifically, it's not justifiable. It's not justifiable ecologically or from a climate perspective because it makes climate change a whole lot worse. But the Forest Service, it feels compelled to do this for economic reasons. And so they do, but politically, they try to spin it as something else. They try to spin it as underbrush thinning or prescribed fire, when in reality, these are logging projects. And at the same time, the logging companies get rich doing these logging operations on public lands for pennies on the dollar, and they take a certain portion of that money and turn it around to campaign contributions to a lot of different members of Congress, Republicans and Democrats. Unfortunately, both sides of the aisle are taking campaign contributions, many of them from the industry. And then they push those policies back on the Forest Service, oftentimes through language and appropriations bills that put pressure on the Forest Service to get the cutout more, articulate timber targets. And the whole system is basically institutionalized corruption. It has to change.
How often does logging happen in California, and how can we keep track of this?
Well, on national forests, it's constant, and private lands as well. It's something that happens every day, except in the higher elevations in the winter when there's too much snow on the ground for logging to occur. In most cases, the public is just simply not aware that this is even happening, because most of the logging on national forests that's conducted by the U.S. Forest Service is done out of sight. It's not done next to the popular campsites or trailheads where people are hiking or camping. It's not done adjacent to the most popular recreation areas. It's done out in the more remote areas, off the beaten path, on the dirt roads, outside of what we call the beauty strip. And for that reason, a lot of people don't even know that it's happening. But people can go on the websites of any national forest in the state of California, Tahoe National Forest, Alaska National Forest, the National Forest in Southern California, like the Los Padres National Forest, and many others. And they can actually click on links for land and resource management, and then click on projects. And they'll see all the projects, all the logging projects the Forest Service is proposing. Now, bear in mind, it's all under euphemisms now. They used to just call it logging, and now there's a whole series of deceptive euphemisms that they use to kind of shield the reality of it from the public, like thinning, forest health, fuel reduction. But make no mistake, if you look at these projects and you download what they're proposing, you'll see they propose widespread removal of mature and old-growth trees, oftentimes up to 8 or 10 feet in circumference. And so that's what we're talking about. You know, we're talking about trees that you'd have to have two people to reach their arms around and touch fingertips. And they're calling that, they're telling the public they're doing underbrush thinning.
You have an example in your New York Times op-ed about what happened in Yosemite National Park. The park began an unprecedented commercial logging program, with the park's superintendent, Cicely Muldoon, agreeing in August 2021 to initiate projects on over 2,000 acres of forest in the Yosemite Valley area under the auspices of thinning with no prior public notice. And then that logging was halted in early July by a lawsuit, and a lawsuit that was filed by the Earth Island Institute. So what is the status of that project?
Yeah, thank you. And my organization, the John Muir Project, is part of Earth Island Institute. So we're the ones who are bringing the lawsuit to try to get compliance with the federal environmental laws and public participation and science here. And so right now, the logging is halted, at least temporarily, while the legal briefing occurs, but it could start up again as early as late next month, and we hope that doesn't happen. But the main thing is, kind of back to my earlier point, is that Yosemite National Park is also under this kind of pressure now. It didn't used to be, but these days it's under pressure because there's a lot of big trees and a lot of timber that the lumber companies want, that the biomass companies want. Burning those trees for energy. We call it clear cuts for kilowatts. And that's what's happening on the park right now. The Yosemite National Park staff have not been honest with the public about this. When pressed, they say, well, we need to do prescribed fires. We need to thin underbrush and small trees the size of Christmas trees. Well, no one's trying to stop any of that. No one's trying to stop prescribed fires or thinning underbrush. What we're trying to stop is industrial commercial logging that's killing and removing the great majority of the trees up to 20 inches in diameter, which is over 5 feet in circumference. Many forests don't even have many trees over 20 inches in diameter. And so a lot of these areas that they're calling thinning are basically clear cuts. And they're also doing post-fire clear cutting as well. And it's just destroying important habitat. And it's certainly not going to curb future fires.
Who decides what can be cut?
Well, it's a good question, because there was no public notice, no environmental analysis, no public comment allowed, that we don't even know a lot of the details. And Yosemite National Park is not being very forthcoming with details. And so we're trying to find out a lot of this information on the fly as these two logging projects were actually happening. And we don't really know all the answers to that. In fact, you don't even know where an area is planned for these sorts of projects until oftentimes it's happening. You know because you see the log trucks rolling down the road in the middle of Yosemite Valley. Mm-hmm. And so, we don't know, but what we do know is that the comments from the park in the press have been highly misleading. And when we've gone to these areas and seen what they call thinning, what we've seen is something that's closer to a clear cut.
Well, you can find Dr. Chad Hansen's op-ed at yourcallradio.org, The Case Against Commercial Logging in Wildfire-Prone Forests. Dr. Hansen is co-founder of the John Muir Project and author of Smokescreen, Debunking Wildfire Myths to Save Our Forests and Our Climate. And let's take a few callers who've been waiting patiently. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Thanks for holding.
Hello. I wanted to ask your guest a question. Is it conceivable that it's possible to remove a lot of the debris or overgrowth on the forest floors in order to mitigate some of these dangers of widespread forest fires? I don't know how you would do this. I mean, we got massive forests in California, Oregon, and Washington. And I'm wondering, since inmates are used to fight these fires, if it wouldn't be better use for those inmates to be paid a reasonable amount to go in and try and clear out some of this overgrowth and underbrush that might cause more serious problems with the forest fires. And I'm just curious to hear what he has to say.
Well, that's a great question. Thank you for asking. There is a way to do this. It's very, very effective. It doesn't involve any logging whatsoever. And it's called fire. It can be prescribed fire. It can be what we call managed wildfire, which is basically a lightning strike occurs that's out in one of the more remote forests and it's not near a home or a group of homes. And you just allow that to burn without trying to suppress it. And the reason I say that's so effective is that previous fire will, for a certain number of years, modify the behavior of the next fire. And we saw that, in fact, in the Oak Fire that just burned several weeks ago, southwest of Yosemite. It burned very rapidly, very, very intensely through previously logged forests. But when it got to a recently burned forest, it basically slowed way, way down and just crept along and then basically petered out. Now, the Yosemite National Park has a fire management plan. And it has had this plan for years. It's actually a really good plan. And what it says is, in the communities that are inside the park and in adjacent to the park, the emphasis is going to be on removing some small trees next to homes because, of course, it's risky and dangerous to have an ignition next to homes. But in the other 99% of the park, the direction to manage the forest is with prescribed fire and managed wildfire. We support that. And it even says that they can remove some really small trees if they really feel it's necessary, trees, seedlings, and saplings, basically, if they feel it's necessary before fire. We support that, too. We're actually trying to get them, through our lawsuit, to comply with their own fire management plan. So this is a really key point because their fire management plan is backed by sound science on how you best manage forests. Their logging projects are way out of compliance with their own fire management plan.
I want to ask you a little bit more about prescribed burns and get your thoughts about what happened in New Mexico and how, you know, people like you should talk to the public about this. A New York Times piece ran in June, the government set a colossal wildfire. What are victims owed? Two prescribed burns got out of control, becoming New Mexico's largest recorded wildfire. But despite the backlash, experts say it is necessary to thin forests in a region primed for destruction. I mean, this was just such a tragic, tragic case. It's rare, but it does happen. So what are your thoughts on that? And how should officials talk to the public about these prescribed burns?
Well, this is another really, really important question. So we need more fire in our forests. Fire is natural in our forest ecosystems. It's natural to have small fires and big fires from an ecological standpoint. And in fact, it's natural to have mixed intensity fires where they burn mostly at low and moderate intensity in most places where, the mature trees survive and remain green and alive, and even a lot of the small trees. And certain patches, it burns at high intensity and kills most or all the trees. That's actually natural too. And a lot of wildlife species depend on that. So we need need fire in our forests, and we can accomplish that through either managed wildfire or prescribed fire. The problem is that we need better controls on when prescribed and guidelines on when prescribed fires are set by land managers. So you do not want to set a prescribed fire during hot, dry, windy conditions, because as I mentioned earlier, wildfire spread and behavior is driven primarily by weather and climate change. And so if you've got a hot, dry, windy day and you start a prescribed fire, it's going to become a big wildfire. That's just a fact. It's going to become a big fire. You're not going to be able to control that once it gets to a certain size. And that's exactly what we saw in New Mexico. There were actually two fires. One was started as a prescribed fire when the Forest Service ignored numerous warnings and ignored the weather conditions that were hot, dry, and windy, and they started the fire anyway. That should not have happened, and communities paid the price for that mistake. And the other fire was started by previous thinning operations, tree cutting, where they were doing these logging operations, and then they burn the slash debris, the branches and the treetops after logging. They pile it into big piles and they put accelerant on it, and then they light it up and they let it burn. But it basically smolders and smolders for weeks and weeks and weeks. And you get those hot, dry, windy conditions, that smoldering can turn into a big fire. So you actually had their previous logging and so-called thinning starting one of the fires and their prescribed fire starting the other. In both cases, we need reform.
Well, we also have an email from Barbara who wanted to know more about firefighters who are in prison and they've had great difficulty getting hired. We will do a show about this because Governor Newsom signed legislation in September 2020 that does allow firefighters who were in prison to become professional firefighters once they are released. So it's a really important story, and we'll definitely do a show about this in the future. Thank you for that call, Greg. Let's go next to Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill. Thanks for holding.
Hi. I'd really like to thank your guest, Earth Island Institute, which the Muir Project is under, is a great organization. All the things he's saying point to the need for coordinated efforts. It's almost like we need the precautionary principle implemented in our legislation and our activity. I would point all listeners to see the two of the documentaries about climate change, Bring Your Own Brigade, as well as Tidewater, which talk about all the challenges, or they talk more of the challenges of getting people to understand how bad it is, even after deadly fires and flooding. We really have to look at the entire thing. And Bring Your Own Brigade does talk about how the type of forestry activity after, you know, all these plantings by corporations speeds up the fire. But there's so much that needs to be done, as well as the federal government needing to build housing. We can't be losing all the housing that we do from fires and from floods and everything else, and expect that the private sector, which is profit driven, is going to replace them and also build for increasing population.
Well, thank you for the call, Bill. We actually did a show about Build Your Own Brigade in August 2021, a really important documentary. Thank you for that. Chad, your thoughts and then final thoughts. We've got about a minute left.
Yeah, I really appreciate the comments. Bring Your Own Brigade is an outstanding film. Just really covers the issue with a lot of heart and a lot of candor. And I think that's so key right now. I guess final thoughts are this. We need to do a 180-degree shift in terms of how we're addressing these issues. Right now, our focus is still on backcountry logging and subsidizing backcountry logging in our forests, and also backcountry fire suppression, and very little of the resources and attention is going to protect communities directly. The only way that the science tells us it's effective, which is devoting the resources right to the communities, home hardening, defensible space, evacuation assistance, community fire safe shelters. That's where we need to go. So we need to shift that. We need to get rid of all those logging subsidies and redirect them into a jobs program, including to keep wildland firefighters employed in the off season, doing that defensible space and home hardening, and for much greater pay than they're getting right now.
Dr. Chad Hansen co-founded the John Muir Project in 1996. It is a project of the Earth Island Institute. He is the author of Smokescreen, Debunking Wildfire Myths to Save Our Forests and Our Climate. You can find his op-ed about commercial logging at yourcallradio.org. Dr. Hansen, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Thank you. We will definitely continue doing shows about fires. And if you have any guest or show ideas, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to David Latulipe for engineering our show. And we hope you can join us tomorrow. We are going to drill down on the climate portion of the Democrats' bill, which passed over the weekend without support from one Republican. It includes $370 billion in renewable energy tax credits over 10 years. It also includes unprecedented support for new drilling, which is why many frontline communities oppose it. Scientists say it's significant, but the fight continues. We hope you can join us tomorrow. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.